Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Americano podcast. I'm sorry it's been a while since the last episode, but that's because we've been very busy putting together and launching the first edition of The Spectator in America, The Spectator US edition. And I'd like to encourage all Americano listeners to subscribe, which they can do by going to www.spectator.us/subscribe. And there you can take advantage of one of our offers. I would encourage you to do that. We're all pretty pleased with the magazine and how it's come out. So back to Americano. I am joined today by Daniel McCarthy, who is a contributing editor of Spectator USA, as well as the editor of Modern Age. And we're going to be discussing impeachment and the future of the Republican and Democratic parties. Dan, you wrote an excellent piece for us yesterday in which you said that impeachment was regime suicide. Can you take us through exactly what you meant by that?
Well, the ironic thing about both the downfall of Richard Nixon and the Bill Clinton impeachment in 1998 is that arguably both of those experiences, as unpleasant as they were for the country, they kind of tested America's institutions and America's institutions passed the test. So Nixon did not have to be impeached. The mere fact that his support was collapsing and it was clear that an impeachment would happen and that he would very likely be convicted and removed was enough to motivate him to resign. And following his resignation, there were actually a series of much more important events involving examinations by the Church Committee and others of how the FBI and CIA and other American intelligence agencies had involved themselves in the political process. So in a way, that was actually more important, I think, in terms of sort of Americans and their understanding of their government than the Nixon resignation. But the Nixon resignation itself was a test that the country passed. And I think everyone felt like the country had gotten beyond this. It was over. And it cast a little bit of a shadow, of course, on the 1976 election, which was the next presidential election between Gerald Ford, who had been, you know, Nixon's VP, and Jimmy Carter. But it wasn't, you know, a kind of overwhelmingly important issue. And then with the Clinton impeachment in 1998, it happened. It failed to get a majority. The fact that you couldn't even get a simple majority in favor of convicting and removing Bill Clinton in 1998 in a Republican-controlled Senate really meant that the country's judgment as a whole, even among many Republicans, was that that Clinton shouldn't have been removed. And as a result, you know, I don't want to say that there were no hard feelings after the Clinton impeachment, but again, there was this sense the country had overall come to a definite conclusion, and there was not a kind of lingering, festering wound. And then in the 2000 election between Gore and George W. Bush, there really wasn't much of a shadow of the Bill Clinton impeachment remaining. With Trump, I think that you have a very different situation where there's been this loss of a sense of America as a cohesive nation, as having a kind of national consensus.
You call it a national consensus. Yeah.
There's a sense now that we're already very much fragmented and that there are these very powerful fault lines between the parties and between different regions of the country. And so it seems to me that you're not going to see the kind of national coming together that you did even after the Watergate scandal and even after the Bill Clinton scandal. I'm not saying those weren't traumatic events, but they were traumatic events, again, where the country was able to kind of reach a firm conclusion. With the Trump situation, I think you're going to see lingering, festering, really, you know, sort of intense animosity, especially since the impeachment effort is almost certainly going to fail.
But if we see the kind of national consensus of America, the democratic consensus you talk about in your piece, if we see that as a post-Second World War phenomenon that lasted up until the 90s and early noughties maybe, do you think that it just deteriorated? Obviously, it deteriorated for a large number of reasons. But do you think perhaps those impeachments that you talked about, the Nixon and Clinton ones, themselves tore away at the consensus?
They did to some extent. They certainly had an effect of weakening it. Although, with respect to the Nixon situation, it's interesting because Nixon wins, you know, a 49-state landslide in 1972. He wins the electoral votes of 49 states. His popularity, you only get a majority of the country saying that Nixon should be impeached and removed in the last month of his presidency. So not until a month before he resigns do you actually find over 50% of the country saying that he should go.
Yes.
So...
And you had a very different media environment then.
And a very different media environment as well. And also the two parties were very different. The Republican Party had conservatives and liberals. The Democratic Party had its southern wing, as well as having a progressive wing. So there was much more of a jumbled sensibility. And this, out of this jumble, you actually got more of a consensus. There was more of this sense of, you know, the parties themselves have their differences. They have differences between the two parties. But therefore, we're all Americans. We all have to kind of reach a judgment together. Now that sensibility is gone. And in part, yes, it was Watergate and the aftermath of Watergate. And in part, it was things like the Clinton impeachment. The Clinton impeachment happened, by the way, because the Republicans seemed to believe that they could still tap into that kind of consensus. Mm. They seemed to think that if they could prove factually, which they did, that Bill Clinton had lied under oath, that therefore they would be able to sort of bring all Americans together to say the facts in themselves have convicted Bill Clinton, and therefore he should be convicted and removed through the impeachment process. Which didn't happen. People said, you, for partisan purposes, are taking a very small issue, this affair with Monica Lewinsky and the fact he lied about it under oath, and you're trying to blow this up into something to justify impeachment, when in fact it really doesn't. It's a very small matter. And so the public basically was not on the side of the Republicans.
And let's get on to the suicide aspect of this now with Trump. I mean, it feels to me, just in a sort of less profound long-term way, it feels to me like a suicidal step for the Democrats to be taking. I mean, I think it's a great way for them to manage to lose an election that they could very well win.
It's very high stakes. And there are many ways the Democrats can wind up losing this. One is if the American people decide that impeachment is a circus and it's unjustified, and they wind up being a little more sympathetic to Trump afterwards than they had been beforehand. Now, Trump's tweets in the last few days have seemed so kind of panicked that one wonders if that's going to be the case. One wonders if, in fact, the American public will be more anti-Trump as a result of impeachment because of the way he conducts himself under the stress.
But do you think, I mean, I often think there's this sort of animal cunning with Trump, and that perhaps he is trying to look more panicked because he sees the opportunity.
That's, in the past, every time it has seemed as if Trump has done himself in and has said the wrong thing, he's wound up bouncing back. Maybe that will happen again, or maybe this is the time when his luck runs out and he's on his ninth life and the cat is, you know, dead after this. With Trump, it is absolutely difficult to predict. But there are other ways that Democrats can wind up losing, right? So even if they wound up getting exactly what they wanted and they removed Trump from office, that makes Mike Pence president. And then Mike Pence would, be the obvious Republican nominee in 2020. He's, you know, Democrats will say that he is blemished by having connection with Trump. But personally, he's going to be extremely different from Trump. So the question will be, will the American people feel as if Pence is the same sort of volatile, controversial figure that Trump is? Or will they feel that Pence is a kind of reassuring figure and that America doesn't want to have three presidents in the span of 12 months? In which case, it seems to me that Pence would be in a very good position to win the 2020 election. And Democrats would then, and Pence would actually be eligible to run then for another term in 2024.
But it's interesting you say that, because I'd have thought from your other things you've written that you'd see Pence as a true representative of a party that really no longer has a foothold in America.
Oh, I think that's generally right. But the only circumstance where I think Pence would have a good chance is one in which Republicans are so outraged, pro-Trump Republicans, that is, 90% of the party, is so outraged at the betrayal of the president that they wind up supporting Pence as a way to stick it to the Democrats for what they did with impeachment.
Yes.
So I think it would actually, it's the one thing that would really superglue the Donald Trump base to Mike Pence.
That's the only thing that could.
The absolutely only thing that would, that's right.
But, I mean, of course, if that scenario happens, you could easily have Trump running as an independent or something like that.
You can't. If you get impeached and removed...
If he stood down without being impeached. You think he could be removed?
Well, I don't really think he can be removed. I'm saying, hypothetically, if the Democrats got exactly what they wanted, and they say that they are doing this in good faith and that they believe he can be removed.
Yes.
If they believe that he can't be removed, then I would say this whole effort is very much in bad faith, that it's only an electoral ploy. And if that's the case, then I think even people who don't like Trump should look at what the Democrats are doing and say, you should not be using something as serious as impeachment for mere political purposes like this, that it's in fact even worse than what was done with Bill Clinton in the 1990s.
And how true, it's been speculated quite a lot that Pelosi and the Democrats are playing a clever double game here because they want to also take down Biden, and they see this as a way of hurting Biden by attacking Trump because obviously exposes Biden.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case with Pelosi. Whether there are other factions in the Democratic Party that would like to see this take down Biden as well, I think that's quite possible. And it is interesting to me that, you know, you had the left wing, I don't want to say the pro-Sanders wing necessarily of the party, but the left wing of the Democratic Party. It was putting a lot of pressure on Nancy Pelosi to begin some sort of impeachment proceeding. And it seems to me that that left wing would not be sad at all to see Joe Biden go down. It would much prefer to have Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders.
It's more the squad than the Bernie Sanders wing of the party.
It's more the squad, that's right. But I think, you know, the squad and the activist base behind the squad is certainly more comfortable with a Warren or a Sanders than they are with a Biden.
Yeah, the squad, we should explain for English listeners, is the four radical socialist congresswomen who are causing so much fuss.
That's right. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the ringleader,
the ringleader. And then it's Ilhan Omar, Presley, and
Rashida Tlaib.
And Rashida Tlaib, yes. And so, I mean, let's talk about this, you know, how you, regardless of what happens with Pence and things, you think impeachment could cause a sort of collapse in, the consensus could go from vanishing to completely gone. You think it
could? Oh, I think that's right, yes.
I mean, you know, a lot of people love to talk about civil war, but are we talking this is a sort of way towards a civil war?
No, what we're talking about in some ways is almost parallel to what we're seeing happening in Britain right now. There's this sense that these institutions, especially with these innovations like the new Supreme Court that Tony Blair introduced and the Fixed-Term Parliaments Act and so forth, that they've actually added up to a series of institutions that make governing impossible. And I think that's what we'd be headed towards in the short run with the United States, that basically there would be no possible even functional governing consensus, even a plurality governing consensus.
The checks and balances would just be in deadlock.
Not just the checks and balances, but the people themselves, the American people. I think the Republicans would be radicalized by the impeachment effort. They will, you know, see Democrats as basically trying to stage a coup d'etat, as trying to, you know, overturn an election, basically overturn two elections, right? Trying to retroactively overturn the 2016 election and proactively, you know, interfere in the 2020 election rather than leaving this decision to the people, right?
Yeah.
So impeachment is a political process conducted by Congress as opposed to a process in which the American people have a, you know, more or less direct say as with a presidential election. I say more or less because, of course, the Electoral College complicates things a little bit, but there's still a sense that the American people feel as if they have a direct, you know, engagement with that process, whereas with impeachment, it really is something conducted by the media and something conducted by the Democrats who control Congress. It's not something that speaks for America as a whole.
And let's talk more about that Brexit comparison, because something that fascinates me, obviously. But I think, I mean, in Britain, we're already seeing the breakup a little bit of the two main establishment parties. I mean, you've had parties splitting off now. You had Change UK, the Brexit Party. And it's because the established parties don't really have large enough constituencies themselves. I don't think the breakup has been as dramatic as people thought. And in fact, at the last election, what was odd is that both the parties saw an increase in the share of their vote. Do you think we could see finally a situation in America where the two parties start to break up? And I mean, the Libertarian Party's never been a great success here, but you've had third party candidates have success.
You could see an opening maybe for an independent candidate of some sort, although it's hard to imagine who that would be. You know, maybe Tucker Carlson, you know, a figure like that.
Well, because I suppose in the media, everyone would assume that candidate would have to be down the middle.
It wouldn't be down the middle. You're right. That is the assumption that people in the media have. They think of it as being a Michael Bloomberg kind of character. And in fact, it would be someone from really either the far right or far left. I shouldn't say, when I say far right or far left, what I mean is simply not within the establishment of either one of the, you know, left-wing or right-wing parties. Well, you know, I'm not saying some sort of lunatic, but what I'm saying is someone who's simply not institutionally embedded within the
parties. Well, Tucker Carlson isn't a lunatic. He's a very intelligent commentator.
And he's not a politician. He's not within the Republican Party as, you know, a kind of establishment figure. Basically, what I'm saying is I think you'd have a Trump, but instead of doing what Trump did in 2016, someone might just run, you know, directly as an independent. Although even that, you know, as Ross Perot showed, is a difficult path to follow. It seems to me that you could get a more chaotic situation where the two parties as simply umbrellas still exist, but they become much more factionalized and broken down underneath those umbrellas.
Yes. And I mean, you're perhaps already seeing that in the Republican Party a bit.
Well, in the Republican Party, you're seeing, I think, a steady change and shift from the kind of post-Reaganite party that you had with the two George Bushes, a party that tried to be a little bit conservative, but also somewhat centrist and somewhat able to uphold the, you know, military interventionist consensus and uphold the welfare state and, you know, simply try to do these things more administratively intelligently, perhaps.
Yes. Or uphold the regime, as you might call it.
Uphold the regime, exactly, yeah. Right. So you had basically, I mean, Reagan, you know, people talked about the Reagan Revolution. Reagan was not necessarily an extremely radical president, but he really was quite a shift from the kind of presidents that, not only on the Democratic side, but that a Eisenhower or a Nixon had been in terms of their domestic policies. With the Bushes, you basically saw an attempt to kind of neuter the Reagan Revolution and make it a bit more palatable for the American mainstream, so to speak, or at least what the establishment thought of as being the mainstream, what the elite thought of as being the mainstream. And actually, that didn't work out very well. My story in the print edition of Spectator USA talks about this, about how, in fact, the electoral map that re-elected George W. Bush in 2004 was already a dying duck. It was something that, you know, barely succeeded in 2004 and was inevitably going to fail any time thereafter.
And you call it anti-populist republicanism in that piece, which I think is quite an interesting phrase, because it sort of suggests that, as there indeed was, there was a sort of populist republicanism beforehand that regime has sort of squashed for a long time.
That's right. And I mean, it's actually very interesting because even though in some ways the Nixon domestic policy resembled that of, you know, certainly the first George Bush, nevertheless, a lot of Nixon's supporters were people who were quite right wing and populist, especially in 1972, when it was a contrast between Nixon and George McGovern. Mm. You know, that was Nixon's silent majority, as he called it. And the silent majority was also very similar to the Reagan Democrats in the Reagan era. And these were people who were not necessarily free market ideologues. They were people who were actually very comfortable with certain aspects of sort of the welfare state or of policies that were designed to help the working class or the middle class. And they were basically a proto-populist movement. Mm. And during the Bush, the two Bush presidencies, that was kind of shoved under the carpet. And there was this sense that, well, we want to keep the votes that these folks are giving us. However, we will just give them the policies that Wall Street wants to have. And there was this sense that you could reconcile that. And the way to reconcile it was by converting the Reagan Democrats, who were basically sort of union, blue-collar worker types, just put them into evangelical churches, and that will glue them to the Republican Party. Yeah. And it turned out that actually didn't work out very well, because in part, it actually, the evangelicals were a slightly different population than the silent majority and the Reagan Democrats. But also, what wound up happening is that as the evangelical movement became more identified with the Republicans, it became less popular. And you started seeing evangelicalism losing some of its strength, especially among young people, that it had when it first entered politics.
And that the idea of that what we talked about in the 90s a lot of the values voter was actually not really true.
It was partly true, and it still is. But values voters, I think, are also economic voters.
Yeah.
But there are two separate groups of economic voters there. There are the suburban types, what, you know, are sometimes also called the soccer moms. And then there are the rest of the country, the people who, you know, have worked in factories or who live in small towns. And the economic interests between these two groups are actually quite divergent. Mm. And values for a time was something that could kind of stick those two groups together despite the economic tensions. But I think that is less the case now, especially because what you're seeing is that the people who feel economically most hard-pressed also feel as if they should be willing to fight harder now on the values issues. This is the Sohrab Amari-David French divide.
Yes.
David French is basically popular with the economic winners, with the people who live in the suburbs and who are the soccer mom value voters. And I think Sohrab Amari's position, you know, which is more hardline and militant.
Yes, we did discuss this last time you were on, but we should probably fill in,
in case
listeners don't remember, that this is a sort of spat, a media spat between David French, who's a writer at National Review, and Sohrab Amari, who wrote a column against David French.
Yeah, Sohrab Amari and David French are both Christian conservatives.
Yeah.
But Sohrab Amari is rather more hardline. He's outraged, for example, by Drag Queen Story Hour and wants to have congressional hearings about this. And David French takes a more civil libertarian, perhaps, version of Christian conservatism. And the interesting thing is, even though the politics of Trump are generally not about Christian conservatism, especially explicitly so, nevertheless, The divide that you see between Amari and French mirrors quite exactly a divide you see among, you know, sort of other types of voters over things like immigration, between the hardliners and the people who want a kind of conservatism that is able to work with liberal institutions. And so that's why I think that you actually have this coalition, I sometimes call it, you know, sort of the faith and nation coalition that puts together the sort of Sohrab Amari types with the immigration restrictionists and, you know, the Trump base. So it's a very complicated happening, but it is a divide between, you know, that kind of hard right on the one hand and then the more liberal right with David French and with the, well, with the Never Trumpers. I mean, it's the Jonah Goldberg and David Frum and Bill Kristol and so forth.
But as these factions sort of try to stick together and form coalitions, we seem to be quite a long way from that at the moment. And we also have, as you suggest in your piece about impeachment, a regime that is getting increasingly desperate and is increasingly reluctant, as we see with Brexit, reluctant to face the ballot.
That's exactly right, yes.
And so, well, obviously, impeachment is, lots of people have said this, but I think it's true that impeachment is a way of avoiding direct democracy. And, well, direct democracy is a misleading phrase, I know, but and it's similarly in Britain. We have the Supreme Court and we have the Labour Party ducking a general election in their attempt to thwart Brexit.
That's right. The risk here, and you see it happening in different ways on both the right and the left, is that a establishment that has lost, you know, sort of the mandate of heaven, that no longer has very much popular support, will be able to circumvent democracy long enough to stay in power for a few more years, to get a couple more presidents that are suitable for, you know, sort of the 1990s mentality. And that what this does is it winds up building up the pressure, which is eventually going to explode, which we already did explode in terms of Brexit and Trump in 2016. But if you now try to reverse that and put this pressure back in the pressure cooker, it may very well come out even more explosively in the future. So Donald Trump might be only the beginning of the kind of populist figures that we see in politics. And I suspect they will be both on the left and on the right.
Yes.
That Sanders and Warren and Trump are only, you know, sort of the first stage of what's coming if the establishment doesn't face the music.
But interestingly, you're seeing that very differently to how a lot of people see it, which will be that sort of Trump had flirted with this very dangerous politics and that sort of ignited the fire. What you're saying is igniting the fire is the people who are trying to put it out.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, but the ironic thing is that the establishment understands this. So you recall back in, it's a long time ago now, 2008, Bill Kristol put Sarah Palin on the Republican ticket as John McCain's running mate.
Yeah.
Why did he do that? Because he understood this dynamic.
Yeah.
He's you know, he's a smart guy. I disagree with him on almost everything. But he understood that John McCain did not have the legitimacy in the eyes of the Republican Party's own base, whereas Sarah Palin had a, you know...
It was a sort of elite move. It was give the rubes something, right?
Give the populace something.
Give the populace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So even then, they understood that if they didn't do something to secure that base, they would be in serious trouble. And George W. Bush in 2004, 4 years before the McCain-Palin ticket, George W. Bush, when he did the values voters thing, that too was a desperate ploy to try to, you know, sort of bridge this gap. It's been very clear, really, for the 20 years now, that the Republican Party is pulling apart in terms of the sort of the militancy and the sort of right conservatism of the base, and the, you know, sort of center-right liberalism of the elite.
Yes.
And various attempts to bridge that, Bush in 2004 with values voters, McCain and in 2008, but with Palin on his ticket, have failed.
Trump did the opposite to the
exactly.
In picking Pence as a sort of establishment.
Well, Pence was a choice not so much because he was establishment, but because he was a Christian conservative who would reassure Christian conservative voters that even though Trump himself clearly is not a paragon of Christian virtue, that nonetheless the Christian part of the party, which is a big part of the base, would still have a prominent seat at the table and would have a powerful voice in the administration. And, you know, Trump has been very good about identifying the constituencies within the party who are willing to support him and giving them what they want, even to the point of, you know, giving the neocons something by putting John Bolton in as his national security advisor. Now, obviously, he wasn't going to go to war for the neocons, but he would at least give them a few personnel slots.
It's interesting about the Christian element to it, because Trump, in his UN speech last week, mentioned LGBTQ rights as being very important. And that's not the sort of rhetoric you might have expected from Pence. Is that would be fair to say?
It's hard to say. Pence actually got into a lot of trouble a few years ago because of this Religious Freedom Restoration Act within the state of Indiana. The Republican legislature in Indiana passed this, what's called a RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and Pence wound up, I think he vetoed it in the end, or at least he certainly circumvented it, in order to not have corporate America boycott the state of Indiana, because Indiana was not providing enough protections to, you know, sort of LGBTQ, however many letters I'm now supposed to use, alphabet Americans, basically. Yeah, yeah. So Pence has actually been a little bit more pragmatic on these questions than his reputation would indicate. But you're right, with Trump, you also saw this at the Republican convention in 2016. So you had Peter Thiel, who's, you know, an openly gay man, and also, I think, Ivanka Trump. Both of them mentioned, you know, sort of gay rights as being things that belong in the Republican Party now.
Yeah.
And that would have been unimaginable, you know, in 2000 or 2004. But even though you have that happening, you also have Trump giving Christian conservatives the policies they want in terms of religious protections and also the appointments they want in terms of the judiciary. So Trump is able to satisfy these very different constituencies in a quite sort of intelligent way.
Yes, and in fact, he may even be speaking to a new liberal consensus about religious values versus, you know, gay rights or things like that.
Well, I wouldn't say a religious, I wouldn't say a liberal consensus.
Small L liberal, yeah.
Even then, I would say it is Trump's sense of transactional politics. He understands this group can give up so much, but it can't give up any more. And this other group can give up so much, but it has its limits as well. And so you're able to actually piece together a coalition, even of people who dislike one another or have principal differences with one another, as long as you abide by certain limits within the lines of the coalition. And Trump, you know, as a old-time real estate guy, has an intuitive feel for this. It's also something you pick up in New York City, because New York City has so many different ethnic and religious and other sorts of political blocks that in order to survive within the politics of the city, you have to have a brilliant sense of coalition politics. Mm. And Trump has that. And that transactional sense is something that I think serves him well and serves him better than a more ideological kind of politics serves his rivals.
And do you think his transactional sense will help him get out of the impeachment crisis, if it indeed is a crisis?
Well, it's, as I say, it's more of a crisis for the regime and its legitimacy than it is for Trump. I think it's a very high hurdle to get across for the Democrats to actually convict and remove Donald Trump, considering, you know, this is the first time we've seen an impeachment where the president's party controlled the Senate. I mean, this is certainly the first time in modern times. With Nixon and with Clinton, both times it was the opposite party that was in control of the Senate. So you're taking on a Republican majority, and you need to get a two-thirds supermajority in order to convict and remove Trump. That, I think, is going to be impossible. So basically what you're seeing here is something that's intended to embarrass the Republican Senate, something that Democrats will use against Republican senators in the 2020 election, and something that is intended to embarrass and damage Donald Trump heading into the 2020 election. But I don't think it's a good faith attempt to, you know, do justice and remove Donald Trump for principled reasons, because nobody imagines that that can actually happen.
What I find amazing is that anybody believes that it's a good faith. Do you think people in their minds, in their sort of deep consciences, actually believe this is a good faith attempt?
Well, certainly, the polling supports exactly what you say, that, you know, I think something like 51% of Americans are saying that they see this as being primarily a political ploy as opposed to something that is, you know, has merits. Maybe that will change. You know, it's hard to say what will happen, but I think Americans are becoming increasingly, you know, sort of aware that impeachment is a political process. With Nixon, you could say, you know, what had happened was so bad that everyone had to agree that that his resignation was necessary. With Clinton, it was clear that, you know, what Clinton had done was contrary to the law and the sanctity of the law that he should have been upholding. But the matter itself was so small that it wasn't something to merit impeachment. Now what you're seeing is this real fracturing of, you know, sort of the Democratic activist base insists that Donald Trump is a fascist, he's a racist, he is destroying America, and he must be removed. And that's, you know, maybe, you know, 30% of the Democratic Party that believes that in a really hardcore, you know, take no prisoners way. And then 30% of the Republican Party believes exactly the opposite, that Donald Trump is the country's savior, and any attempt to remove him is a coup d'etat and is attempted revolution, that, you know, we're going to have guillotines and Jacobins in the streets and we need to fight back against this. So it's all this impeachment thing is doing is radicalizing people. And then everyone in the middle, they look at this and they say, this is being fought out between two quite radical wings of the Republicans and Democrats, and that there's nothing that smacks of good faith, you know, sort of law and order here. This is just politics being driven by radical elements.
Dan, it's always fascinating to talk to you. I hope we'll do another impeachment podcast in the near future.
Oh, I'm sure we will. Thanks, Freddie.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Americano. And I'd like to encourage you all to give us your feedback, positive comments or constructive comments only, please, to podcast@spectator.co.uk and say anything you like there as long as it's reasonably polite.